So this meditation that we're engaging in here, we call it insight meditation or vipassana, or more accurately, as Peggy mentioned last night, samatha vipassana. And again, the word samatha means calmness or steadiness. And it refers to a calmness or a steadiness that allows us to pay attention to what's showing, that allows us to be present with our experience in the present moment. And it often comes up in individual meetings, in small group meetings. What often comes up is a statement, I can't concentrate, or my concentration is not very good. I can't do it because I can't concentrate. My mind is just all over the place. And my own inclination is to not give so much importance to concentration. With concentration, when we have the idea of concentration, actually this isn't what I intended to talk about at all. But anyway, when we talk about concentration, when we think about concentration, we generally have an idea of a kind of concentration that's a kind of a fixing, a forcing of the attention just to stay with one thing. And so when I say, okay, I'm going to concentrate on my breath, we can easily have this idea that I have to use a lot of force and a lot of effort and a lot of striving to just contain my attention on this breath, to just feel this breath. And then the idea comes, well, if I'm really concentrated, then I shouldn't be experiencing anything else. My thoughts should stop. I shouldn't be drifting off into thoughts. I shouldn't be drifting off to the sounds. I should be just focused and just concentrated. And so when we have this idea of concentration, very easily we get into this idea of I have to make lots of effort. And that struggle for concentration, for this type of concentration, that the effort that goes into that puts a lot of pressure on oneself. And the effort that goes into that can actually create a lot of tension within the body and the mind. It creates a lot of struggle. It creates a lot of a lot of conflict. Because I look and I have this idea I should be concentrated, but I look at the reality, and the reality is I'm anything but. And so there's a conflict. And wherever there's conflict, we could say that conflict is friction. There's a kind of a banging together or a rubbing together. There's friction. And wherever there's friction, there's heat. And very often in the meditation, the kinds of experiences that we have when we're focused on this concentration and trying to get this concentration, the kinds of experiences that we have are the experiences of friction. And those experiences are heat and pain. And so very often, the pain and the heat and the difficulty that we experience in the meditation is simply from this friction of making too much effort to concentrate. And I would suggest that in the sitting, in the walking, in the standing, if you're experiencing pain, rather than just reacting to it and moving, and maybe even before taking the attention to it and exploring it, as I've suggested in the instructions, just ask yourself the question, am I making too much effort? Am I trying too hard? So to come back to this meditation is samatha vipassana. Samatha is calmness and steadiness. And this kind of fixing and stressing and striving to force this concentration is anything but calmness. And so if we notice ourselves getting tight and tense, trying to make this effort, if we notice ourselves getting caught up in, oh, I don't have enough concentration, I need more concentration, just to see if we can just say, ah, okay, there's that struggle, that striving again. And just see if we can just kind of take a breath and just, oh, okay, just calmness, steadiness. And just to release some of that pressure and that tension and that striving and that effort for that concentration. Now, in the meditation, concentration is important, and the Buddha identified concentration as a necessary factor for awakening, for liberation. But the kind of concentration that he referred to and that he intended was not this forced, fixed focusing, but it's the kind of concentration that I would be willing to bet all of us have experienced when we're doing something that we're really interested in and that we're really enjoying. When we're interested in something and we're enjoying it, we find that very naturally, without effort, the attention just focuses. Yeah, has everyone experienced that? Very naturally and effortlessly, the attention comes to a focus because of the interest and because of the enjoyment in it. And so, as a factor for awakening, as a factor for insight, this is the kind of concentration that we would like to cultivate. And so we cultivate that by being relaxed, being shanti. Okay? Allowing ourselves to just be, to not be beating ourselves up and struggling with ourselves and criticizing and judging ourselves, but really just being, just let ourselves be just as we are. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. However we are, just to let that be. And this is the calmness and the steadiness. And then not just letting it be, but letting it be with an interest in really experiencing that, really knowing just how we are and who we are and what we are in this moment. And bringing that interest to the experience. And in that being present, in that being interested, taking interest, the concentration very naturally comes. And then we can be focused. And then the mind starts to quiet a little bit, maybe. The body starts to quiet and settle a little bit, maybe. And if it doesn't, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And in that settling and in that quieting and in that calmness and steadiness and that interest and that non-reactivity, that non-forcing, in that there's a kind of spaciousness. There's a spaciousness that can allow for insight. So insight isn't something that we figure out. It's not something that we make up. It's not something that we can force to happen. But it's something that comes to us. And again, the name of it, insight, is seeing from within. And so insight is this seeing from within. And very often, insight comes to one and there's a sense of, I already know this. There's nothing new here. But somehow it's more clear now. There's greater clarity. And because the insight has come from within, of course we already knew it. We already know. We already know this wisdom. But it's clouded over. It's covered over. And the meditation is one of uncovering. So it's not acquiring more and getting more and thinking about and getting more knowledge. It's allowing for spaciousness, allowing for openness. And in that, the insight can come. This insight can come, and it can show itself in a number of different ways. So as I've mentioned, sometimes it comes, there's a seeing, there's an insight, there's a knowing, and along with it there's this thought of, oh, this isn't new, I already knew this. But now it's more clear. So with the insight there's a sense of greater clarity. And sometimes this is how insight shows itself. Sometimes insight shows, and I would say not very often, but what we tend to look for in insight, what we tend to look for is kind of the big bang, the big sudden flash. And we think, well, if I just get nice and calm and peaceful and quiet and just sitting very still, and if I could just get my mind to shut up, then I could be very calm and peaceful, and then there's going to be this big flash of insight, and all of a sudden I'm going to understand everything, and for the rest of my life it's going to be pure bliss. I'm sorry, but it doesn't very often happen like that. Okay? And yet, so often, this is the idea that we have, and we keep sitting here waiting for this big flash, and in that waiting, and in that idea, very easily we can miss some other understanding, some other form of understanding. And so yes, it would be wonderful. And yes, I think probably for some people sometimes it does happen. So not to rule it out. But also not to hold on to this as an idea of how it is or how it should be. Okay, so again, allowing for insight to show in its own way. So sometimes it may come perhaps as this big flash. Sometimes insight comes much more subtly, we could say. Sometimes I think this may be a much more common way that insight shows itself. And it's in the form of not really having a sense of anything happened, no sense of any particular flash of insight or understanding, nothing in particular happened. But at some point, I reflect back and I realize, which in itself could be an insight, but I realize that I'm seeing things differently than I did at some point in the past. I'm responding to the world and to my life, both inner and outer, in a different way than I did in the past. And I can see that this change in response, this change of how I am within myself and in the world, is because of some change in understanding. But there's nothing that I can point to and say, oh, it's because of that, it's because of that. But it is from insight. And insight sometimes is like this. Sometimes insight does show, not in the big flash, but there can be just a moment when something is understood. There's just an understanding. And this understanding, this insight that comes in a moment can be seen to somehow be directly related to some experience in the past, which at the time was completely meaningless. And so I have some experience, and at the time it means nothing. There may not even be any awareness of it as being a particular experience. And then at some point, and it can be years later, there's suddenly some flash of understanding, something comes and it says, ah, that's what that was all about. Now I remember that. And now I see the meaning in it. And one of the messages in this, an important message, in relation to being on retreat. Sometimes we're on a retreat, and in our daily lives too, but particularly on the retreat, we can easily be sitting and breathing and breathing and thinking, what am I doing this for? There's nothing happening. It's a waste of time. I might as well go home. It's so boring. I'm not getting any insight. But the fact is, we don't really know what's going to come out of this moment. We don't really know. The most insignificant moment can, at some point in the future, be seen to have tremendous meaning, tremendous significance. And so if we're sitting and we're feeling happy and joyful and blissful, wonderful. If we're sitting and we're feeling bored and pain and miserable, it's wonderful. Because we don't know what's going to arise from that, and we don't know when. And I might just mention an example of this for myself, which happened, an insight, a seeing, which happened for me on the retreat here in Israel last year. And I spoke about it at the time. And so the insight came a year ago. It was almost exactly a year ago. And the insight rose out of an experience, an incident that had happened, I'm not going to say how many years ago, but I was 7 or 8 years old when it happened. And it was something which completely forgotten about. It just wasn't in consciousness at all. And suddenly this insight came, and it was, oh yes, of course. And I might add that the incident that happened so many years ago, just to give you a little bit of hope and a little bit of encouragement, was not a pleasant incident. In fact, it was quite unpleasant at the time. It was my first Hebrew lesson. And the teacher was this old man who carried this big wooden stick, and he had this long beard, and he was kind of hunched over, and he'd walk up and down the row of desks, and he would go whack, and it was not pleasant. But what came to me, the insight that came to me, which was based on this, had to do with the actual Hebrew lesson and what I was learning. And I must say, I wasn't a very good student, and I didn't learn a lot. But what came to me last year was the very first word that I learned in Hebrew. And probably you can guess what it was. Shalom. Okay, and as I explained in the retreat last year, I could see very clearly the image of the book. I was sitting, it happened during a sitting, I was sitting, eyes closed, and suddenly the image of the book came to me. And there was the word shalom, it was written this way, and written the other way was three words, hello, peace, goodbye. And it suddenly dawned on me, the insight that came was that all the meditation instructions can be summed up in this one word, shalom. The meditation instructions really comes down to whatever we're experiencing, whatever comes to us, whether we're sitting or walking or standing, whether we're in retreat or whether we're in our daily life, our so-called real life, if we can just remember shalom, hello, whatever comes, welcoming, saying hello, whatever comes, pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral, boring, peace, peace. Whatever comes, being able to say goodbye, releasing, not holding on, but to say goodbye. And so the meditation instruction really is just shalom. And so when we look, if we reflect back on our day today, if we reflect back on our experiences through the day today, how many of us in a moment of experiencing pain have been able to say shalom, hello? How many of us have been able to say shalom, peace? In a moment of experiencing something pleasant, the wonderful food, the relief at the ring of the bell at the end of the sitting, the moment of lying down after lunch, all of us have these pleasant moments. How many of us in these moments of pleasure have really been able to say shalom, goodbye? When we look in the retreat and look in our daily lives, I think we can see how often we're not able to do that. We can see this tendency with unpleasant experiences within ourselves, pain, illness, emotions, the unpleasant experiences within us, and the unpleasant experiences in our interaction with the world, with other people, with situations. We can see the tendency with the unpleasant not to say peace, but to say, get away. Go away. I don't want you. I don't like you. This is a tendency that we have. We can see the tendency when something is pleasant, when we're enjoying something and it really feels good. There's a tendency to want to hold on to it, to keep it. It's very difficult to say shalom, goodbye. Some 2,500 years ago, the Buddha recognized this. The Buddha noticed this tendency, these tendencies, this tendency to want to hold on to the pleasant and to get rid of the unpleasant. And the word that he used to describe these tendencies, the Pali word, the language that the Buddha spoke was Pali, and the word in Pali is dukkha. And dukkha is generally translated as suffering. And personally, I don't really like this translation because it has some implications which aren't quite accurate with the meaning. So another translation of dukkha is unsatisfactoriness. So the Buddha recognized that in his life, and I think if we're honest, we can say in our lives too, we experience unsatisfactoriness. Things in life are unsatisfactory. And the Buddha went through his whole spiritual quest, his whole spiritual search, and he ended up sitting under a tree in Bodh Gaya in India, which is a place full of dukkha. Some of you have been there. But a wonderful place, a really wonderful place. A very powerful, very special place. But so he ended up sitting under a tree there, and he determined to sit under this tree until he awakened, until he understood the nature of things, And actually part of his process was actually recognizing when he was making too much effort and striving and struggling, and remembering that the times in his life when he felt the most peaceful and the most calmness and steadiness were actually when he wasn't making a lot of effort, when he was just being. And so the Buddha was able to just be and just allow. And he was able to say shalom over and over and over again. And in his awakening, he had a number of insights. And some of these insights he formulated into what he referred to as the Four Noble Truths. So four truths, so four things that he felt were actual fact and which applied to himself and to everyone and to all of life. And the first of these was the fact that we experience dukkha. The first thing that he identified as a fact was this experience of unsatisfactoriness. And people are often critical of Buddhism in the sense of saying, well, it just talks about suffering, it talks about dukkha. Who wants to know? There's enough of it already. Who cares? Why should I look at my dukkha? Why should I sit here and experience my pain? Why should I go into my pain and explore it? Why not just move and get rid of it? So the Buddha identified this as a fact, and the significance of this lies in the fact that if we want to understand something, we have to know it. We have to know it. And the way to know something is to experience it, to study it. So we come to know it through our experience of it. The Buddha also, his whole spiritual quest, his whole spiritual journey was based on the experiencing of dukkha, the knowing of dukkha, and the determination to find a way of living which was free of dukkha. To find a way of living which was without dukkha. And so he came to this first truth. The bare fact is we experience dukkha. And the significance of this, again, is that in order to find a way to be free of dukkha, first we have to understand dukkha. Okay? First, we have to know that, yes, I am experiencing dukkha. Because if I don't know that, if I don't have any sense of experiencing unsatisfactoriness, then there's no need. There's no need to do anything to try. I'm already living without it. So to be free from dukkha, first there has to be the awareness of its presence. And the unfortunate thing is, it's quite unfortunate that some of us are rather stubborn. And some of us, unfortunately, have to experience a tremendous amount of dukkha before we're convinced to look for a different way of being. Some of us are really fortunate, and just experiencing a small amount of dukkha is enough to say, okay, there's got to be another way. But some of us are stubborn. Some of us are difficult. And I would hope that all of us can see our dukkha in a way that we can recognize, yes, this is it. This is dukkha. This is unsatisfactoriness. This is suffering. And then the Buddha went on from there. So first step is recognizing the presence of dukkha, recognizing this is suffering, this is unsatisfactoriness. And then the Buddha thought, well, if I want to be free of that, then it may be helpful to understand what's causing the unsatisfactoriness. What's the cause of unsatisfactoriness? And the Buddha looked into his dukkha, he looked into his unsatisfactoriness, his experience of unsatisfactoriness, and brought calmness and brought interest to it and brought inquiry and experiencing it and allowing it to be. And what he noticed was this inability to say shalom. What he recognized was these tendencies to want to hold on to the pleasant and push away the unpleasant. And what he recognized was that the real unsatisfactoriness, the real cause of unsatisfactoriness, was not in some experience. It was not in some body sensation. It was not in thoughts running through the mind. But rather, it was in this very attempt to hold on to the pleasant and to push away the unpleasant. The attempt to hold on to the pleasant creates unsatisfactoriness. The attempt to push away the unpleasant creates unsatisfactoriness. And I think, again, if we look in our lives, we can probably find examples that show this to us very clearly so that we can say, yes, I know that. I know that. How many times have we been in the midst of something unsatisfactory and we're struggling as hard as we can to get rid of it, to make a change, and it seems like the more we struggle with it, the more unpleasant and unsatisfactory it gets. And we see in pleasant experiences, we try to hold on to them, but the very nature of experiences is to change. And that holding on is a struggle against this natural process of change. Trying to hold on to something that's changing. And this can be in relationship to anything. So the Buddha identified this holding and this pushing away, grasping and aversion, greed and hatred. The Buddha identified greed and hatred as the causes of unsatisfactoriness, the causes of dukkha. So, we have the first two of the Four Noble Truths have to do with suffering, with dukkha. The second two is the good news. The third Noble Truth, the third truth that the Buddha came to through his experience, through his awakening, through his insight, the third truth that he came to was, yes, there can be an ending of dukkha. It is possible to know the ending of unsatisfactoriness. And not only is it possible, but it's possible in this very lifetime. It's possible in this very moment. And so the third truth was the ending of dukkha. And so easily when we get caught in our suffering, when we get caught in our pain, when we get caught in our mind states and emotions, get caught in these difficult situations, we very easily forget even the possibility of this. And so easily when we forget the possibility, then we forget the interest, the investigation, the looking, bringing the attention to, allowing for. And so very important to remember this third truth. Yes, there can be an end to this unsatisfactoriness. And since the cause of the dukkha, as the Buddha identified, is the grasping and the aversion, the greed and the hatred, then the ending of it must be the ending of grasping and aversion. The ending of grasping and aversion. So what's the ending of grasping and aversion? Shalom. Hello. Peace. Goodbye. Welcoming. Being with. Releasing. Not holding on. Not pushing away. And so perhaps in the retreat, in the days here together, perhaps we can see if we can keep reminding ourselves of these. Oh, the fourth noble truth. The fourth noble truth, I'm not going to go into it tonight. The fourth noble truth is the path. The path that brings the understanding, the path that brings the insight, the path that allows for the insight, the revelation of the insight, which releases, which allows for this release. And we're running out of tape, so we'll continue with this. So the fact of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the ending of dukkha, the path. The path being the path which can give rise to this insight, this liberating insight. This liberating insight, which is the understanding of the actual nature, the true nature of things, the true nature of life. And so in the retreat, in the sittings, in the walking, in the standing, in the meal times, in the rest times, throughout the day and throughout the night if you're not sleeping, see if we can keep reminding ourselves of shalom. To see where we are holding, to see where we're pushing away or avoiding, to see where we're ignoring or denying. And to see in our own experience, is this causing unsatisfactoriness? Is there unsatisfactoriness in here? Because again, the Buddha said many times not to just believe something because someone else has said it, but to look to our own experience. Unless dukkha is our own experience, then we're not going to look into it to see if there is another way. And if we don't look into it, then we won't find another way. So to look within ourselves, to look at our experience in each moment and see, is there unsatisfactoriness here? And if there is, what is the cause of it? Is there holding? Is there pushing away? Or is there some other cause? And so each moment becomes a moment for meditation, a moment for taking interest, a moment for experiencing our life just as it is, and a moment with the potential for this liberating insight. So remembering again that this insight does come in different forms, in different ways, and even to let go of our ideas of what insight is, to let go of our ideas of how insight comes, of when it comes, to let go of our ideas of how it should be. And in that letting go, in that letting go, more and more allowing ourselves just to be, and letting go of this sense of having to do. I have to do something. I have to do this. I have to do that. What should I do now? I'm experiencing this. What should I do about it? Nothing. Just be. Say shalom. And not just say it, but feel it and mean it. And bringing this attitude to each moment. And then we see. We see what understanding comes. We see what liberation comes and what liberation really means. So let's sit together quietly for a couple of minutes.